Hello and welcome. I'm Patrick Curtis, your host and chief monkey, and this is the Wall Street Oasis podcast. Join me as I talk to some of the community's most successful and inspirational members to gain valuable insight into different career paths and life in general. Let's get to it. Member S-Man540 shares his journey from a small boutique bank to a reputable bulge bracket investment bank. How he struck out the first time with on-cycle private equity recruiting while at the boutique, and how he recovered the second time around while at the bulge bracket. Learn how intense the on-cycle private equity recruiting process is and why it's similar to a hostage situation. Enjoy. S-Man540, thanks so much for joining the Wall Street Oasis podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Patrick.
Cool, man. So it'd be great if you could give a quick summary of your background.
Sure. So I'm born and bred from New York. Both my parents are physicians. So growing up, I always had an interest in healthcare, but didn't really know what I wanted to do professionally. And then ended up going to a target school for undergrad. And pretty much everyone was funneled into either consulting or banking. And I was studying healthcare policy at the time. So I thought I'd try to combine the healthcare that I grew up with just this banking push that everyone else was doing. And turned out I actually ended up really liking it, really having an interest in finance. So I did a internship in a markets group at a bulge bracket my sophomore year, leveraged that to break into front office role with in investment banking with a boutique, a healthcare boutique my junior year for my internship. I accepted that role full time. And then after 6 months on the job, received a lateral opportunity to switch to a bulge bracket, still in investment banking, but within a different vertical, and have been doing that for the last 8 months now.
Great. And real quick, so you specifically, going back to kind of undergrad, when you were, when you made that decision of like, okay, finance does interest me, what that was, you said sophomore year?
Yeah. It was to be exact, it was my first semester of sophomore year. I had joined an on-campus business club, and it was a stock-focused investment club. I joined the finance team, and we made pitches to the finance to the investment committee every other week, and just really enjoyed the process. Got me interested in valuation, and kind of took off from there.
Got it. So let's talk a little bit about like specifically the recruiting aspect of you know, you kind of knew early on enough, like sophomore year, it's not, if you had come to that realization junior year, it might have been a lot harder, right? So tell me a little bit about just when you knew that's what you wanted to do, what did you do, kind of what were the steps you took?
Pretty much the first thing, and I think this is one of the benefits of having a target school and especially being in on-campus clubs and involvements, is I just reached out to the older kids in the club that I knew had done finance internships and had successfully recruited. And I just said, where do I start? What's the first step? And, you know, people start recommending you by the guidebooks and, you know, Wall Street Oasis, of course. And people recommend, you know, you start basically doing exactly what you're doing with them, but with people who are actually alumni and professionals who either run your club or run your major. And so LinkedIn was pretty new at the time and was just starting to become really popular. So I made a LinkedIn and just started cold emailing alumni from my specific business club, since it had been around for a long time. And not just my business club at my particular school, but also at other schools in the country, because it was a national business club. And I just, you know, found a commonality, said, you're in my business club, or you're from my school, you're from my major, let's talk. And then through those coffee chats, someone recommended me to a markets, specifically a market research program at a bulge bracket. And now it probably would even be too late as a sophomore. At the time, it was around November of sophomore year, and the interviews were starting in January. Now it's moved so early, I probably would have had to be doing this in the summer of my freshman year, because now the interviews are starting right when you get back on campus your sophomore year.
So tell me something. So like, that's for the sophomore summer, or that's for junior summer?
That's for sophomore summer.
So it's happening about, it's happening about, what would that be, 9 months before the start date of the internship?
Just about 9 months, yeah.
So not as crazy as private equity recruiting. But
no, not nearly as crazy as PE recruiting.
But still, okay, so you have enough time here, so you're like doing it on camp. Like you said, back then, it was only a few years ago, but back then, right, you basically were prepping in your sophomore, right at the beginning of sophomore year, you're doing a lot of that networking because the interviews were kind of November, December, January of your sophomore year. Now it's almost like right when you get back on campus, you need to be doing almost freshman, end of freshman summer, you need to almost be doing this networking and getting ready. And, you know, this is now October 2019. So people who are just back on campus now, if you're looking for a sophomore summer internship, get on it because it's
definitely
the clock is ticking.
Definitely scrambled. There's definitely still boutiques that are recruiting. I know some of the bulge brackets have closed or are just starting to close, but definitely a lot of boutiques go actively recruiting right now.
Talk to me a little bit about like this sophomore internship buzz and craze. Well, at least 5 years ago, I know sophomore internships were very much like, oh, you don't really need it. It's just almost impossible to get. It seems like that has, from speaking to a few people, like the pendulum has swung to where it's almost now like for the most competitive candidates, like the sophomore internship is critical. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I think the biggest problem is that now, because for junior summer, recruiting is over a year in advance. Recruiting happens about 15 months in advance to 12 months in advance. Mm-hmm. So kids are doing interviews for their junior year internship before even starting their sophomore year internship. So because of that, in order to get the internship or in order to get the interview to begin with, you have to have something on the resume to be able to talk about.
Started the sophomore summer internship, you put that on your resume to help you land junior summer internship interviews.
Exactly.
This is insane.
Exactly.
This is insane.
What
do you put on the resume? You have nothing. You have no experience. You just say future intern.
You just
put
incoming.
You put future, you know, incoming sophomore summer intern, you know, in this division, this boutique investment bank or whatever. And then that helps you land the bulge bracket summer analyst interviews. Got it.
Exactly.
Okay.
And a few people also do, you know, we'll do a corp dev internship their sophomore year and sort of say, you know, I'm really interested. The old story was I'm interested in corp dev, but once I did it, I wanted more valuation work. Now the story is, well, you know, I wanted to get some client side and some industry exposure before I go into a particular vertical, or, you know, I'm interested in product banking and I wanted to get industry exposure before trying for my internship, you know, something like that.
I think that's really interesting. Can you unpack that a little bit more in terms of how the stories have evolved in terms of what the story you tell recruiters?
So, I mean, it's become a challenge because you can't really speak to experience anymore.
Right.
It used to be for me, at least, especially I did my sophomore internship just because it was something I was interested in. And I liked following the markets. I thought market data and market research would be great. Mm-hmm. I did the internship. There were things I liked. There were things I didn't like. And I said, maybe I can find something that's a better fit. And that, you know, that was true, but that was also an easy story to tell. Now it's sort of, you have to tell them why you didn't apply to their sophomore internship in investment banking in, you know, July after your freshman year. And so you have to basically say, I mean, you know, everyone has a different approach, but what I tell the kids, especially from my business school from my business club that reach out to me, you know, I tell them just, you don't need to make any excuses. Just say, have a reason for why you're doing your particular internship this summer. So if you got a corp dev gig, say, you know, I really think that it's going to give me industry exposure and I really love this industry. But, you know, it's something that I wanted to do to get the client side so that I could be a better banker in my junior summer. And I could be a step ahead of the kids who've only done banking.
To be clear, this is advice for people who missed the boat on like the bulge bracket sophomore applications or something. Sound like, oh no, like I knew I really wanted this corp dev or this other, you know, industry vertical experience, and that's why I hadn't applied, blah, blah, blah. Just to make it a legitimate excuse. In reality, it may have been like you didn't even know you wanted to do banking, right? But that's not
In reality, you know, no 19-year-old should be planning their career 5 years in advance.
Right.
But they have to now.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. So tell me, okay, so let's back to your story. So you're doing this boutique internship your sophomore summer, but you have that kind of lined up on your resume now to try and land the junior summer interviews. When are those kind of start hitting for you on campus? I assume it's on campus recruiting. And tell me a little bit about like the resume drop and the conversions to first rounds and stuff like that.
So it's all moved to higher view at the big banks now. Mm-hmm. So it used to be on campus interviews for all the target schools. Now they just send you basically a link to a video platform. It's not even a Skype interview. It's just you talk into a blank screen and it's then reviewed by first an algorithm and to screen out certain patterns that I'm not aware of. And then it's then reviewed by the on-campus recruiting team, who will watch all of these videos of these kids answering five behavioral questions on, into staring at a camera. And then you'll pick the kids for the super day from that. So what that really has meant is it 100% has turned into networking. And it's all about networking with people when typically the firms will come on campus if you're a target school in around February or March of your of what is your sophomore year, but for junior year summer. So we're talking, you know, 16 months in advance of internship start. They'll come, they'll do a networking session. You'll get cards, you'll get emails. Reach out to those people right away, schedule calls, start contacting them, maintain a dialogue. And then as soon as the applications will open, typically depends on the firm. Some of them open right away. Some of them open in March of sophomore year, again, you know, for junior internship. Some open July 1st was when pretty much all the bulge brackets opened this year. So, you know,
so almost a full year, about a year,
2 weeks before.
Got it. Okay.
And then basically because it is this hire review system, you don't really get a chance to have a first shot at the interview. And they screen, you know, they'll screen hundreds of candidates per school, for what ends up being 20 to 30 super day invites.
How did you prep for looking into a camera and talking into a camera and not feeling super weird about it?
I mean, I was, the hire view thing actually started literally the year after I recruited. So I didn't have to do it, but, you know, most people that I've talked to and asked about it, or that I, you know, people have reached out and asked me for help, and I sort of put them in touch with friends who are younger, and they basically said that they literally just recorded themselves over and over and over again on their computer, answering simple questions they knew they were going to get, like why investment banking, you know, why'd you choose your major in college, just tell me about yourself in general. And then, you know, you basically just watch video of yourself and you notice weird things that you're doing.
Weird ticks.
That you're not looking at the camera properly and so on.
Yeah, you get the weird ticks, you get the weird, you know, the ums and the, you know, the filler words, you start catching those. Yeah, and then try to clean it up and polish it a little bit better. Got it. Also, well, probably trying not to sound like a robot after you've practiced 100 times.
Exactly. Trying to make you sound like a human is pretty hard these days. So, yeah.
So, okay. So you didn't have to go through that, but you were, it was fairly accelerated in terms of your process. Tell me a little bit about, so you started, they came on a campus, was it around March, you said? March, April?
It was, well, for, so again, those are timelines for today. For me, they came onto campus just as students were getting back, so August. I'm sorry, for the initial networking sessions, for me it was also, March, April, for the network. So like right at the end of sophomore year.
And so did stuff start opening up like for junior summer then? And you already had, you hadn't done your sophomore internship yet, but you had it on your resume?
Correct.
And exactly. what did you exactly. put, were there any bullets under that?
I just put a one line description of what my role would be, you know, working in markets, so on. And then I put, my title was just incoming summer analyst. And that was it. And then the date that I'd be working and the firm. And that was it.
And that's pretty standard nowadays where they expect you to do that. Okay, cool. So they come on campus, you know the game, you're going to go to these networking sessions for all the bulge brackets, all the other elite boutiques, you're collecting cards, and you just immediately start emailing people to try and get on the phone?
Yeah, basically that same night, as soon as you leave, you just start writing your email. And you send them either that night or, you know, you draft them that night and send them first thing the next morning. And you basically just say, really enjoyed speaking with you. Let me know if you can find some time to get on the phone. And then, you know, the hit rate's pretty low for that. Like, you know, you might meet 10 people at the event, email all of them, and only one will talk to you. But the key is just every person who talks to you, you just say at the end, is there anyone you recommend I speak with? And especially if you're at a bulge bracket, the most important thing is talking to the staffer, because at least at our firm here, the staffer is in charge of all recruiting, and it's their full-time job. So they basically, they're a banker, like first-year VP or so, and then they get basically a year of, instead of being a banker, they just do recruiting and staffing analysts on projects.
Okay. So kind of like a very different role. Whoever gets stuck with that.
Exactly. It's basically a treat. I mean, it's a vacation for the first-year VPs.
Right. So they basically are, you're trying to get them on the phone, so you're hoping that one of these analysts or associates or someone who was at the information session will give you that contact.
Exactly.
And then even if they ignore you, your name's out there, you've shown that you've networked.
you've heard that you've at least reached out, and maybe they recognize it, you. So are they who's actually looking at these videos that are coming in? How many videos? I mean, I assume now that it's a video platform, they're basically probably it's like maybe 1,000 people sending videos.
I mean, it's pretty crazy. So for here, I'm actually on the campus recruiting team for the school that I went to.
Right.
And so since it's a target school, it's basically a collection of bankers who are at the firm who went to your school, who volunteered to be on the recruiting team.
Right.
And so it's the same people who go to these networking sessions.
Right.
Are you guys
the one actually looking at the videos, or are you guys ones
we'll literally, and it's analyst all the way up to MD will be watching these videos.
And how long do you guys spend on each video? Do you guys choose like one specific question to focus on, each of you or something like that, and you rank it, and then
it's much more. You watch so many. I mean, I personally have watched, call it, you know, this was my first year with the firm, and I watched probably 15 to 20 hire views from kids from my school, and they basically just said, was there anyone, like, not even rank them, just was there anyone who stood out, you know, and in a positive way, or was there anyone who made an impact on you, or, you know, write down a list of names of people who made an impression. And then it's kind of a black box from there. I don't know.
And
who does the deciding, or
and
how
the
that 50, impacts it,
and the 15 to 20 that you watch, are you watching just one of their responses, or are watching their full like 5 question?
Each question, they time it, and they only give you, it's either a minute and a half or 2 minutes per question. So it's 10, you know, it's
10
it's
minutes per person,
basically 5 to 10 minutes per person.
That's actually a lot.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And you do it over the course of about 2 weeks, or at least I did.
Okay.
Because they sent, you know, the applications open July 1st. It's rolling. We basically started watching hire views right away. And then by like July 15th, they said, okay, here's the kids we've selected for the Super Day.
Got it. Okay. And so you feel like any of the kids you said stood out ended up making it to the Super Day? A few of them?
Actually two did. Mm-hmm. And one got the offer, which was pretty exciting, pretty cool to do that in that process.
And were you...
He also was a kid who had reached out to me before even submitting his application. You know, he had met me at the networking session, reached out, all the standard stuff.
And did you, had he basically, were you, when you were reviewing people, I assume they were just all from your school?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It was, cool. I don't know how the non-target process works, but for us, at least, we only look at kids from our school.
My guess is there's probably just a bucket of all the non-targets get thrown into one massive bucket, and some poor soul has to go through that large bucket.
I could see that being the case. Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. Okay, so let's get back to the process and the timeline. So you're basically on campus. Sure. It's sophomore year. The info sessions happen. You start doing resume. It's not really even, I guess in your case, it was like resume drops. Or who's allowed to do in hire views? Anybody allowed, or you have to be invited?
You have to be invited. Some people don't even get the hire view.
So you basically drop a resume, in other words.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
So it's like getting a first round interview. You do the recording. Hopefully you've practiced to this point so that you don't sound like a robot and you don't get nervous on camera.
Correct.
You submit those, and then tell me about the turnaround time. How long do you hear before it's submitted Super Day or not?
Can be, you know, they do a number of waves of Super Days, because they don't, there'll be some Super Days that they'll only give out one. They'll pretty much always give out an offer, but some Super Days will give out one offer. Some they'll give out like 6 or 7, you know, it's not like they have a number of slots that they have to take each Super Day.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's a yes or no per applicant basis. So because of that, you know, I think for our school, we ended up having 3 Super Days in total.
Got it.
And so, you know, for some of the kids, they found out from submitting their hire view, the earliest they could have found out is 2 weeks. The latest is a month and a half. Or it's even 2 months, actually.
So two to 8 weeks, let's say, in terms of when they would be notified of that they made it to a Super Day. That's really good information.
Yeah.
Tell me about specifically when you said there's 3 Super Days for your school. So there were Super Days.
Yeah.
Is this for your group specifically, or is this firm-wide? Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say it's firm-wide, yeah.
It's a firm-wide Super Day, 3 of them.
Yeah.
And then specifically, so it's not just your school. And it's not just your group. It's basically just for the pool of analysts.
Right. And it's typically they'll have a group of schools or a collection of schools go at the same time. So they'll have, you know, if you went to an Ivy League, the Ivy Leagues will go at the same time. if you're at a target NESCAC, the target NESCACs will all go together. You know, you start to notice patterns, especially when you're interviewing, and you ask all the kids where they went to school, and they went to, you know, the same, very right. similar school. So, exactly. It'll be three super days, and it's not just going to be kids from your school. It'll be a collection of schools.
Is it fair to say you go from, like, traditional targets to semi-targets to non-targets in terms of the super days?
Yeah. I think that's pretty fair.
Do you feel like there's more offers being given in the last two buckets versus the first bucket now that a lot of the is it like more competitive now that there's less interest in investment banking at the maybe at the target schools than traditionally? Do you feel like you guys are moving more downstream?
I've only ever seen the target school process because I don't right. really interact. You know, I only am on my school's recruiting team.
Right.
So it's kind of a tunnel vision view.
Yep.
I can say in terms of, you know, kids who are interested in it, there's definitely a concern at the bank level of kids, you know, taking kids from target schools because in terms of exit ops, they then have better opportunities once they start. And, you know, I don't know if they've run the math on it, but there's definitely an opinion that a kid from a target from, you know, a top target school is more likely to leave than a kid from a, you know, general state school.
Right. So the attrition being such a big issue now for the banks, they almost prefer a potential state school kid who's really smart and going to be a great analyst that has a higher likelihood of staying versus, let's say, a kid from an Ivy League that has a better chance exactly. to jump. So you think that school, let's call it pedigree or prestige, still plays a big factor in private equity recruiting?
For private equity, 100%. Only yeah. because, not on a firm level, but because the headhunters act as screeners.
Got it.
And the headhunters basically determine who gets interviews and who doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, the headhunters, they're just playing a numbers game.
Yep.
They get a fee if you get the job. They don't if you don't. So
right.
they are very... very biased towards the top target schools.
Got it. Okay, fair enough. Tell me a little bit about, so let's go back to your, I keep interrupting because I'm curious about the specifics, but let's go back a little bit to your specific process. So you dropped your resume, you got some hire views, but you didn't go to a bulge bracket. So tell me about what was the thought process of going back to the boutique you were working at for it was your sophomore summer, right? Tell me about...
So my sophomore summer was actually at a bulge bracket, but not in investment
okay.
banking.
Got it.
And then
okay.
junior summer was the boutique in investment banking.
That's right. Okay. So tell me, so your junior summer was there. You obviously got a return offer at the boutique.
Yeah.
And so tell me about, did you try to leverage that offer to land an analyst spot at a middle market, elite boutique, a bulge bracket bank, or what was your thought process when you got that offer, or was it exploding? I mean, like you just didn't have the chance.
Yeah, so they gave me 2 weeks to accept, and it was very conditional, very clearly stated. If I don't respond by, you know, Friday,
yeah,
August, whatever, I lose the offer. And so I did place some calls. I reached out to friends. I reached out to, you know, some of the alumni I networked with in the process, just saying, did your group not take any kids? You know, do you have any spots open? And I just wasn't able to gain. I mean, 2 weeks is not enough time to gain traction really in the full-time process. So right. I figured I'd much rather have a job than do recruiting again. And I did enjoy the internship. I liked the people. So I said, you know, it's still banking. I'm happy in it. Let me take the safe bet.
Right. So it's front office. It's still banking. It's at a good boutique that has a good presence in their industry. So you're like, right. you know, I'm just going to get some good deal experience and be there. So tell me when you came and started working, you know, it's interesting because they put that really tight time frame on you for that exploding offer of 2 weeks, almost to force your hand. Yet, was it worth it? You know, I wonder, is it worth it for them to do that? Because then you look at right. kind of what happened to you and you still ended up jumping, what, very, very soon after, 7 months into the job. And that probably ended up costing them
than usually. I mean, they had to replace me, train the new person, and it's hard to find good people
on the run
for jobs,
yeah.
you know, 6 months in.
Right. So tell me a little bit about that. Like, did you feel when you started with them, was it immediately like you started talking to people, networking now that you were, had the banking job on your resume, now that you kind of were you know, you had that going, you could do it without the time restriction or that exploding offer. Tell me how that lateral recruiting process worked. Was it people reaching out to you, or were you active?
Yeah, so it was route might be a little different than some of the people who lateral, but basically I had done the on-cycle private equity recruiting process as a first year at this small boutique, and just wasn't able to get any traction with the headhunters. Even from a target school in investment banking at a respected boutique, maybe I'm putting the blame somewhere else, but to me, it felt like I just wasn't taken seriously or getting traction because I wasn't at a top firm. Mm. And so to me, that had caused a little bit of frustration, but I was very focused on private equity recruiting. And then just one of my friends, told me that a couple of second years in his group had left early and had left, 6 months earlier than they expected because their PE job said, hey, we want you to start early. And they had openings and they were hiring three laterals. And he just said, are you interested? And part of it was the frustration and part of it was just not gaining traction in PE recruiting. I said, absolutely, here's my resume. And it was, I think our group here at the Bullfrag, it was very, in need of analysts at the time, and especially was having trouble finding people in December, especially it was right before the holiday season.
Yep.
So I interviewed with them. 2 days later, I had a super day, and then I received my offer that Monday. So over the course of 5 days, went from not even, thinking about it to having an offer and starting in a month.
So, okay, so that makes a lot of sense to me. Tell me, but before, talk to me a little bit about that frustration with the private equity on-cycle recruiting process. Tell me, how many recruiters did you meet with? Were there specific recruiters? Did you get any interviews, or just they were for smaller middle market shops only? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I pretty much met with all of the recruiters. I had done a lot of prep. I knew what I was getting myself into. I appropriately treated them like interviews. I felt like the meetings with the recruiters went well, but only a couple of the non-major recruiters, the CPIs, the Henkels, were not sending me any opportunities. Mm. I was able to get two or three interviews at small middle market opportunities, and I was able to get a lot of opportunities in Chicago, which to me, just being from New York City, I had no interest in leaving the Northeast. But, I was only looking at New York, Boston. And so because of that, I was thinking, do I want to uproot my life and apply to some of these PE jobs in Chicago that are expressing interest? And also in terms of the opportunities, it wasn't even I was not getting interviews. I wasn't even getting the emails to ask if I was interested in these interviews or in, potential interviews. That my friends at Bulge Brackets were getting. And I wasn't getting the, invitations to dinner events or drinks events that all of my friends at Bulge Brackets were getting.
Right.
And so to me, I just started saying, okay, there's clearly, a bias here. Let me keep shooting my shot and see how it goes. And then I was just—
So did you get any— So did you do any interviews in that first year?
I did. I got three, cocktail events essentially.
Yep.
And got two on-cycle interviews at very small middle market industry focused funds.
And how did those turn out? You didn't quite get the offers, or you were close?
Both of those I didn't quite get the offers, and that definitely, where I worked had no impact on that. That was purely on
performance,
competitiveness of the candidates.
Yep.
It was more so, in my opinion, especially after the first one, I felt like I did exponentially better in the second interview. And I felt like if I got a third interview, it's like after each interview, I made it to the next round. So the first one met with two people and got the axe. The next one, I made it to the modeling exam and then got the axe. I felt like now that I've done it, if I get a third one, I can lock down the offer. And then just wasn't getting any interest or wasn't getting that third interview.
I've interviewed a few people that kind of gone through the on-cycle recruiting process in private equity in their first year of banking. And a lot of them have started saying, they wish they had delayed. Did you have any of that regret?
Yeah.
You wish you had more prep? I know our private equity interview course, a lot of people do that. And then they're like, oh man, I should have done this a long time ago before I had my shots. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It sounds like you got to reset a little bit because you did lateral, but talk to me a little bit about the prep you did kind of leading up into the interview.
Yeah. So I did purchase the the Wall Street Oasis guide for private equity recruiting. Mm-hmm. And I will also say, you know, not to toot your horn, but in my opinion, it's by far the best guide for private equity recruiting.
Appreciate that.
And the both in terms of the modeling exams, and I think most importantly, just the technical questions on it. Mm-hmm. Every single interview that I asked, 90% of the technicals, I could point to the guide and say he took it from here, or it was, you know, an extrapolation of here.
Right.
And so I had read that over my summer before start while I was in training. You know, the training is pretty much a joke. It's 2 months of basically a vacation before you start banking.
Right.
And so I took those 2 months to basically read through the guide, you know, talk to some of my friends who are in the industry, ask, you know, do practice modeling exams. But I think genuinely to some extent, you can't.
It's hard to replicate it. Yeah. You need the mocks. You need you need a realistic mock interview. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's why we try.
You just need to have interviews to learn it.
We try to encourage people to do like at least one mock interview with an actual private equity professional. Cause we're like, dude, you don't know until you're actually in there 100%. In the hot seat. Like it's very different, you know, than reading a guide and then like practicing in your head or even practicing in front of a camera versus live. But, and the thing with private equity is it's like, everyone's incredible. Everyone's impressive. So it's really about how you come across and how genuine, how passionate, how, you know, or how likable you are really. So it's interesting to me that, it's just interesting to me that more people don't do that, at least with, maybe they do with friends, but they should be doing it a lot in terms of just drilling with that.
100%. Yeah. If I had done, you know, 3 or 4, mock interviews with a professional, I would have gotten the first offer.
Yeah. I don't get. It's like, you know, you spend, what is it, a couple $100 you like have like real live feedback, but it's okay. Whatever. Point is like, it's one of those things where, I think you need to go through it to realize like, oh man, I could have been so much better. You don't realize how much better you can get until you kind of fall on your face for the first few times.
Exactly.
But okay, so that's good. So you were getting better, but you're still frustrated because the cycle passed, and it was on cycle. You didn't get any offers. But at the same time, do you feel like you burned any bridges having talked to recruiters and them knowing you, or did you feel like once you lateraled to the bulge bracket, you had almost had a new rebrand and you could, you were seen in a different light?
You definitely burn bridges if you don't rebrand.
Okay.
And I think part of the appeal of the laddering to the bulge bracket was that it would give me an opportunity because essentially the recruiters get feedback from the people that you interview with. And if they say the kid's not ready, they're not going to send you more opportunities.
Got it.
So, you know, exactly what you said. I needed the rebrand to meet with them again as a second year, having done interviews, having prepped and, you know, being polished for me to come back and say, I'm stronger. This is my new story. You know, get me in front of a fund and I'll kill it.
Got it. Okay. So you're at a specific group, I won't say at the bulge bracket. Did that have any impact in terms of the type of opportunities you were seeing?
Definitely. I think especially once I did, you know, on cycle the second time, I realized that firm is incredibly important, but especially now that the cycle has gotten so early, even more important is what group you are. So I was only getting a small handful of generalist offers. You know, the M&A kids were getting every, you know, offer, basically every interview under the sun.
So if you had to rank the groups, what's the best groups to be in for private equity recruiting? I think I know the answer, but go ahead and what would you say is the best?
100% top three is M&A, financial sponsors, and LevFin in that order.
Got it. Okay.
And then tech is a close fourth.
What about like a restructuring group for like distressed funds or something like that, or credit funds?
I wasn't, you know, I didn't really look at any of those opportunities, so I'm not sure, but
I'm biased. Sure, I'm biased because I was in restructuring.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyways, go ahead. So you get the rebrand, you're getting some opportunities, not as many as the M&A kids, but you know, you're still getting some looks. Your story is really down pat now. You kind of had that full year under your belt of banking. I assume you have some deal experience at this point.
I did. I had closed the transaction before I left, or my transaction had announced before I left my first firm.
Yeah.
And then I had a second transaction announced in about May with my current firm.
Awesome. And so you had some good stuff to talk to. Did you tell me how you prepped specifically for those? I assume a lot of the interviews focused on the specific deals you worked on.
Yeah. A first round interview with every firm is basically just a 5-minute, you know, conversation of walk me through your resume and a few technicals, and then 25 minutes of walking through your deals.
And so how do you, any tips specifically on how, I mean, we just released something new on the PE course where we actually have private equity professionals walking through deals they did in banking. We actually have audio now, like almost like a podcast form where people can listen to how they talked about their deals in a PE recruiting setting. But I'd love to hear, is there any tips you have in terms of people prepping for like that transaction or that deal walkthrough? Like, what should they know?
Yeah. I mean, the very first question of, or it's either the first or second question of the Wall Street Oasis guy that has all the technicals, it tells you basically exactly what everyone's going to be interested in your deals, which is, you know, first and foremost, just what was the size, what was the multiple it went for, you know, PE, EV to EBITDA, book value, if, you know, if the firm, if applicable, and, you know, that's sort of the rundown. The next one is the investment thesis. Why does the deal make sense? Which then always turns into, would you invest in the deal?
Right.
So on and so forth. Basically just three bullets about, you know, why the deal was happening. And then in addition to that, just have three merits and considerations. So, you know, why a company would buy another company is different than why the company is a good company. And it's important to know that those are two different things. And if you answer why they bought it as just why the company was good, you're answering that question wrong.
Right.
And so, you know, just merits and considerations of the target company in the deal, and then, you know, items of diligence and just further points of diligence. And I literally, for prepping it, I opened up our diligence tracker and I literally just looked at some of the high priority diligence items that we had actually listed for the process, and, you know, why, and thought, just took a couple seconds to say, why was this high priority versus low priority? Why was this so important? And so, you know, some of the things like, how do they, you know, like what's the CEO succession plan was high priority for us because the deal was a private equity backed deal. So they really cared if management was going to stay or, you know, if in particular, it's like, is the company going to hit their numbers? You know, what's their revenue retention look like? Basically, you just look at what the high priority items are and you think, why is this important? And then when they then ask you, what would you diligence further about the deal? You then just list off the three things from your diligence tracker.
Right, in terms of the highest priority items and why they,
exactly.
why you think they're important. So okay, so
exactly.
that so that's great. So really drilling down your deals, knowing them inside and out is obviously critical to being successful. So you felt like so tell me about the process. So how many, now that you're at this bulge bracket, you're getting a few more looks, you're a little bit more polished now, you have deals you can really, you know, sink your teeth into in terms of the interview and show that you know your stuff. Were you doing a lot of the modeling on these deals so you're able to kind of talk to that?
So I, on the deal that I did here, I actually did not do the modeling. But you very quickly learn how to pretend you did the modeling, which is
how do you pretend?
The M&A team
And
ask them for the model.
Got it. So even if you didn't do the model, you can at least be familiar with enough with the model where you can say like, yeah, I was in the model and da, da, da. But you know, do you have to actually say, yeah, I built it? Or do you say, yeah, I'm very familiar with the numbers and all the model and the deal? How do you frame it?
I think, especially if you're at a bulge bracket that has a particularly strong M&A team, they're going to, you know, they're going to call your bluff if you say that you ran the model.
Right.
But I think you can very realistically say, you know, we diligenced some of the assumptions in the model and some of the growth targets that, you know, were very company specific or were industry specific. And we worked closely with the, you know, internal team at the company to come up with these assumptions. And, you know, and it's true, especially if you go deep in a process, the M&A guys are kind of just plugging and chugging, you know, and modeling.
Yeah.
It's the coverage group that's actually the one, you know, updating the numbers and actually giving the assumptions to drive the model. So
Got it.
Think if you're honest with that, you definitely would get credit for it, but you also have to be ready to defend if they start asking you, well, why 5%? You know, what growth did you use? Why? Where'd that come from?
And how much industry knowledge do you feel like you needed? Like how deep did you have to go?
It definitely depends on if it's with a fund that's an industry-focused fund or not.
Yeah.
With the generalist funds, 100%, it's not that deep. It's pretty high level.
Yep.
If it's with a fund in your sector, especially, and this is something that happened to me, unfortunately, if they worked on the deal that you're talking about and they were a potential buyer in it, you know,
it's like worst nightmare.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it happened to me where. Essentially, you know, the guy wiped the floor with me because he knew a deeply high level, you know, what the comps were trading at, what precedent transactions specifically he had looked at, you know, things like that. And that's actually one thing I didn't mention that I should have is, in addition to knowing your deal, it's just as important to know, you know, and similar to what multiple went for, what precedent transactions went for, you know, what multiples were used there and what the comps are currently trading at. Because, you know, that for me, especially in this interview, that was the first thing he went to. He was like, well, you know, did you look at and then name a precedent deal that I was not familiar with, you know, in this transaction at all? And I hadn't. He said, okay, well, why didn't you look at that? You know that XYZ. So, you know, it's for an industry focused fund, I would say pretty, you need to have a pretty strong industry knowledge, know the trends, know
the transactions in that space. Know the transactions in that space and know where the comps are trading, the public comps.
Exactly.
Got it. Okay. Fair enough. And so tell me about like just the overall stats. So in other words, like you kind of reached out to all the recruiters. Were they willing to talk to you again? Number one, because you had the rebrand. Yeah. And number two, how many of those conversations led to first round interviews or coffee or you know, cocktail hours and all that stuff?
Yeah. So, some of the recruiters actually had reached out to me, and some of them keep track or will send you, you know, kind of bi-monthly just email blast to everyone that they've met with saying, what's your current status? Do you have an offer or no? Mm-hmm. And so some had reached out to me saying, hey, you know, just wanted to check on your status. And I then dropped, oh, hey, I'm actually at, you know, Foliage Bracket XYZ, would love to meet. And some I just reached out to independently. 100% were receptive. Everyone was, you know, more than willing to meet with me again. And then in terms of where that went, you know, down the line, I ended up getting, whereas before I had, you know, 3 cocktail events throughout the whole on-cycle process and 2 interviews. Before the process even started, I had 6, you know, cocktail, drinks, breakfast events, essentially networking events with the firms. And then as soon as the process kicked off, that turned into 4 on-cycle interviews.
Tell me about the timing of that. When did that happen? I know that just happened, right? Like a month ago?
Yeah. So it's the essentially the end of August, you know, mid call it August 20th. Mm-hmm. Or so the coffee chats start happening. They went on for about 2 to 3 weeks. And then I think it was September 12th.
Were people still in training, like their first year, the people who had just started at the desk, were some of them still in training or they had just finished?
Probably at some groups they had. At our group, they literally had started, the coffee chat started the week after the kids started at the desk.
Yeah.
So their second week on the job, they're having these coffee chats with firms. And then less than a month into the job, they're having first round interviews.
Yeah, for a job that's almost 2 years away.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So just to give people perspective, this is people who are starting the typical on-cycle private equity recruiting process starts 2 years in advance. So in other words, people in September of 2019 were interviewing for jobs that wouldn't start till what, June or July of 2021?
Yeah.
Okay. So just to give people a little perspective of how crazy it is. So, okay. So you're interviewing, that 6 or so cocktail hours turns into 4 on cycle, interviews. Do those immediately go to, in person or like final rounds or how many rounds are there? And let's talk about that.
Yeah. So it's different for every fund, but basically the way it was at all the ones I went to was they just bring you in the morning and they have you interview with people until they give you an offer or send you home.
Got it. Okay. And then tell me about the, you know, were these middle market, upper middle market funds, mega funds, were they, tell me about that pressure with the, you know, doing the interviews all day, they either send you home. Are you immediately going to another fund right after that or how does it work?
Yeah. I got sent home and then, you know, I got told to leave and then less than an hour later, I was meeting with the next one. And I had been at the first one from 8 a.m. until 3 p.m. And then I was at the next one by 3:30.
And then, so you're at the next fund by 3:30. Are they both like upper middle market funds? What would you call,
Yeah, the smallest that I met with was it was like a $900 million fund. Mm-hmm. And the largest I met with was a, you know, I'll call it $10 billion plus fund.
Got it.
So it was definitely a range. There's also definitely a strategy. You know, I was kind of lucky with the timing of mine. They were more spaced out. But the way that some people have it is you're literally at a fund and you get a call with an invite to a mega fund. And you're at, round mid-market fund. You have to make the decision, do I leave right now and go to this mega fund or do I take my chances, things are going well so far, and try to get the offer here and sacrifice the then interview at the Megaphone? So it's a lot of, you know, game theory going on.
And so what do you think, how would you advise people who are going through this incredibly stressful process? It's happening over a weekend typically, right? It's like 2 days, two or 3 days.
It started on Thursday night and it ran until basically Tuesday of the next week.
And tell me, what time are they people? So they have people coming in at like 8 a.m. and how late are people interviewing till?
So typically you'll be there for 5 to 6 hours before you get an offer.
Mm-hmm.
And some people, you know, they're doing these nonstop. I had a friend who was at a Megaphone. He came at the fourth, and it's not like they have slots. They just, whenever they send a candidate home, they call in the next one. So he got a call at around 4:30 for a Megaphone. And he was there at 5. He got the offer at 2 in the morning. So, I mean, he was, you know, he was there for doing some quick mental math, about 9 hours. So
he was there at 2. So they kept interviewing him and people were there interviewing him till 2 in the morning?
Yeah. Or, so it's not nonstop. It's typically they'll have, you know, they'll have you interview with someone. They'll mm-hmm. put you in a room and then they'll discuss everyone that they met with. And then they'll send you home or they'll have you meet with another person. So it's a lot of waiting, too. It's a lot of just kind of sitting in a room for, at some points, an hour. You could be sitting in a room for 2 hours and have someone come in and send you home. Or you could be there for 2 hours. And then after literally just, you met with one person, you're there for 2 hours, someone brings you into the next interview. And so it's just very stop and go and very random.
Man, it's stressful. And then you may get a call in the middle while you're waiting, like, hey, come to this Megaphone.
Exactly.
And you got to make that decision. So tell me about, did you have any of those decisions you had to make in the moment?
I was very lucky that I did not. I had the way that mine worked was I had two on the Friday, the day after it started, and then my other two were on Sunday. So I had, you know, a day of rest in between, which was huge, and both were, you know, one in the morning, one at night. I think, honestly, everyone that I've talked to just says I got crazy lucky, and that's very rare.
Tell me about, like, did you land any offers on that first day?
The first day I did not. The first day, the first one, it was my very first interview in a year and I was a little rusty, but, and again, you know, definitely should have done practice with a professional.
Yeah.
And it did not go as well. The second one, I made it to the final round. And then the third one made it to the final round again. The fourth one got the offer that night at about midnight.
Wow. So you were like, under the gun, you basically just got it. Yeah. Well, that's awesome.
Yeah,
man. Congrats.
And they also, when they give you the offer, some of it depends on the firm, but they told me I had 2 hours to decide, so I had between midnight and 2 a.m to make the decision. I made a decision on the spot, but
what if you fell asleep? Just kidding.
I mean, well, no, there's adrenaline. I was still there. I was,
you were at the office.
It was, yeah. I was there from, you know, 3:30. I was there for 3:30 to midnight, and then at midnight, you know, had my last, I actually was just sitting around waiting for about an hour, and then they came in and said, hey, you got the offer, you're gonna take it, you have 2 hours.
And you just said yes right there on the spot?
I said you know, show me where to sign. Yeah.
Awesome. Wow, man, exciting and crazy. I wish we could do like I wish we could do behind the scenes of that. That would be so intense, like, to see that. Yeah. that whole game theory going down. And tell me a little bit about some of your friends, and tell me about some of them, any stories around where they did jump to try and go to that Megaphone interview and ended up burning out and not getting any offers.
Yeah. I mean, fortunately,
like, any words of warning,
really,
any
friends who did it all ended up with offers, but
they did. Okay.
I had one friend who was at a respectable, you know, $1 to $5 billion fund,
mm-hmm.
and was waiting around basically to hear back if he got the offer or not. Got the call from, you know, top fund, you know, like one of the big five,
mm-hmm.
got the call, said, you know what, I'm going to take my chance, left from what potentially could have been an offer if he had stayed for another hour or so.
Yeah.
And then, you know, did that for a couple hours and landed it, which was an incredibly, you know, I would never
move.
Have done a million years, but
it was a gutsy move.
Yeah, it was, to say the least, it was a gutsy move. But he personally just had felt that his interviews hadn't gone that well at the first one. He was kind of surprised he had made it as far as he did.
Got it.
And he had, you know, met with, you know, the top five fund, had met with them, knew a bunch of kids from school and from his particular group that were there and just felt, you know, chances were good he was going to take it.
So he felt like at this, even though he got pulled into this first fund that was, I would say, a $1 to $5 billion fund, because the interviews didn't go really, really well, but he felt like maybe he was being kept around almost as backup. And you got to be thinking, like, are other offers going out right now and exploding in 2 hours? And is he just being held there? Interesting. Really interesting, the game theory behind all that. Yeah, I mean, I would think if I'm being held, it's almost like you're being held hostage.
Really. Yeah, no, I mean, well, because it's literally, they're like, you sit here while this kid's offer explodes.
I think I know the title. I think I'm going to call this the private equity hostage situation. I think that's what I'm going to call it.
I like that. The
game theory of the entire. I mean, we always talk about the game theory of the firms trying to get the top candidates. Tell me a little bit about, have you heard any rumblings? I know you haven't started in private equity, but from the people in going through the interview, that they're frustrated with the process in terms of how early it's going.
Yeah, the people on the other side hate it. I mean, you know, they are, you know, just as frustrated as us. Especially, you know, a lot of them feel like they're seeing good candidates who have a lot of potential that if they had interviewed in 3 months later, probably would have gotten the job. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them too, just also, you know, it's just very hard to ask someone interview questions. These kids don't have any deals. They only have an internship to go off of. So, you know, for them, they're like, it kind of feels like we're shooting fish in a barrel. Mm-hmm. And what some firms have done to counter that is, especially some of the big firms, they'll have, you know, instead of having like a drinks event or something like that, they'll have coffee chats, and they'll, instead of one or two coffee chats, they'll have like 5 to 10 coffee chats per candidate.
Got it.
And if they really like a candidate, they'll basically meet with them, you know, over and over again over the course of the 3 weeks before the process starts. And then once the process starts, they basically give them like two interviews, you know, they give them a modeling exam. If they pass, they give them the job basically. But yeah, no, 100%, both at the firm that I'll be going to and at people across the board, there's, it seems like no one's happy with how it's going right now.
Hmm. Any advice for people, you know, you came in at an interesting thing because you had that first year under your belt. You kind of had a first bite of the apple, even though you only had a couple interviews. It kind of opened your eyes probably to the process. And then, you know, once you got the rebrand to the Bulge Bracket, you were almost more prepped. But even then, like you said, you had 4 interviews. In the first 3, you didn't get the offer. So being as competitive you are, being from a target school, being a smart kid, having prepped, you still didn't get the offer until that final one, which is surprising to me. You know, I think it just speaks to how competitive it is and how crazy it is. Tell me about, do you feel like any of the mega funds or middle market funds are going later or holding seats open and recruiting later?
I mean, there's definitely some of the top funds even, only they did on cycle, but they only interviewed second years in the on cycle process.
Interesting. Okay.
And they basically,
do you know which funds, do you know which funds those are?
Yes. Silver Lake, chose to do that. I don't know any of the other funds in particular, but okay. Silver Lake made that decision.
Got it. So they said, look, we'll just take our chances with the second years.
Yeah. And I've heard Searchlight did the same, but that I don't know.
You're not sure.
Or, you know, can't confirm.
Okay. Very cool. Anything else? We didn't get too much into like your day-to-day life in banking. I assume it's very much what we've heard before, but anything you want to share about that or the group you're in terms of like the work-life balance? Is it going well? Are the deals you're working on interesting?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think just overall, you know, the banks have very clearly made an effort to try to keep analysts, and it shows.
Are you actually getting weekends? Like, I know different bulge brackets have different policies. Like, I can't remember.
Exactly.
I don't want to say what policy your bank has because it may give it away. But, yeah. Like, can you is whatever policy they're doing, whether it's like I know one is like Fridays, another one's like weekend, like every fourth weekend. I know another one has like pencils down like Friday to Saturday. There's a whole bunch of them out there. Is that actually being enforced?
100%. You know, it definitely depends on your firm and your group. Mm-hmm. You know, at my last job, we had a policy that was blatantly ignored. And you know, it was like we would make jokes about it almost. It'd be like, oh, like, you know, that's like a, you know, protected Friday or like, you know, protected Saturday or something. But
I love it.
But
I think the boutiques have a harder time with it. Right? Don't they? Would you agree with that? Like the boutiques, elite boutiques or smaller firms, like they don't have the extra bench to like be able to absorb.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, my analyst class size tripled between firms. And I mean, you know, at the senior level, the seniors, you know, there's like only about 50% more seniors. So it's like you've got basically double the workforce per person to work on this stuff. And so part of that is they then give you more work, and, you know, and part of it is also just bigger deals require more people. But 100%, it's hard. Boutiques are harder to staff and harder to make these policies for.
Right. Do you think, what do you think in terms of the trends going forward? Do you think it's going to continue? Do you think banks are going to become even more? I mean, I think retention is still a big problem. You see private equity poaching all the quote top talent from the banks. What do you think are the bank's next move? Do you have any thoughts in terms of where it's heading?
I mean, I think honestly, I mean, I think banks are going to keep trying to keep people and going to keep making it better. I mean, you know, we have chats with our group head all the time, and, you know, like different people from the bank, be it HR or bankers, reaching out, you know, just having forums, basically even having some like senior banker or like analyst and associate forums, just saying like, please, like, what can we do to keep you? Just anything, you know. Right. Do you want more money for your seamless dinners? Do you want, you know, more? Do you want Sunday off too? Like, what can we do? You know, do you want to get promoted a year earlier? What can we do to keep you?
Right.
And so, you know, I think it's going to keep going. But to be honest, I just think
where does that balance out? Like, I mean, what would it take? What would it take to keep people on the sell side? I mean, there's got to be, at some point, there's got to be something the banks can do. A lot of people say no because the type of work in private equity, maybe they're just more interested in that. But talk to me about that. Is there something the banks can do?
I mean, I personally think I'm of the belief that at the end of the day, there's very little they can do. You know, the type of work is just not as appealing. And no matter how much, you know, you do towards the hours, they're always going to be hard. But I do think the biggest thing that's been successful here, that, you know, for me at least, and obviously this comes from someone who's leaving, but for me, I've seen work, is just bringing analysts to meetings and making analysts feel like they're part of the team and the process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's very much still, even after all these initiatives that they have, there's still a mentality that analysts are just kind of, you know, replaceable deal monkeys, you know,
cog in the wheel.
We're basically just
the cog.
Yeah, we're basically just woefully underslept robots that can crank through Excel and PowerPoint. And so I think that, you know, really the best thing that the banks can do is just like bring them to meetings, you know, say thank you, as ridiculous as that sounds. Like, just having, you know, your boss come by and say, thanks for the hard work on the pitch, you know, goes a long way.
Yeah.
And, you know, unless they start doing that and analysts become a bigger part of the process, I think if we keep staying, you know, as kind of behind the scenes Excel monkeys, I think it's no matter what, you know, no matter how many protected weekends you get, it's going to stay the same.
Yeah, personally, I think that until they continue to drop the hours even more, more protected weekends, more kind of these policies, but also not just that, I think the early promotions. So the analyst to associate promotion is actually a big deal. I think that actually might really get people to stick around, because if they see a path with no MBA, if they see a path where they actually like to sell and they like the idea of doing transactions, you may actually hold on to a few people each year that you wouldn't have otherwise.
And I will say too, in terms of reinforcing that, I have many friends who are taking pay cuts to go to private equity and who are, you know, missing out on a promotion basically and going from what would be a second year associate at a bank to first year associate at a PE fund, where at the PE fund, you know, associates at the bottom level versus bank, you've got analysts before you and you're a more senior associate. So 100%, I think the early promotions, maybe not yet, but can make a difference.
So tell me about, we're on pay a little bit. Tell me a little bit about pay at the boutique, and then you can give a little slight ranges if you don't want to give exact.
Yeah.
But then tell me about what you've been seeing at your group or at your bank.
Definitely, you know, pay at the boutique was better, way better. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you sort of take a prestige haircut when you go to a bulge bracket.
So tell me, like, base 100 or something, or base 90 or.
I mean, well, the salary is the same pretty much everywhere.
Yeah.
With the exception of, you know, maybe if you're at the top two, you know, investment banks who give 75, and then Centerview, who notoriously just all in gives kids $300K as an analyst.
Right.
But With that exception, it's, you know, base salary pretty much across the board is 85 to 90 mm-hmm. For analysts. And then bonus at a bulge bracket can be up to, call it, you know, 80% for the top analysts.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas at the boutique I was at before, it got up to 120% for right. the top performing.
So you're analyst. Talking, let's say, 90 base and like 100 to 110 bonus. For
exactly.
For a first
yeah.
year
like
analyst,
about
which is
200
crazy.
All in. Yeah.
Yeah, which is crazy for your first year out of school. Not bad.
Yeah.
So yeah, a lot of people don't think that or don't understand that sometimes the boutiques pay more because they understand they
right.
need to attract the
exactly.
top talent. So okay, and then private equity, do you have an idea of what you're going to be getting or what the ranges are that you're seeing from other people?
I think, you know, for most of the people that I've talked to, obviously it depends on fund size.
Yep.
If you're at a fund that's in the, you know, 5 billion plus range, it seems like 250 to 300 is what, you know, all in
mm-hmm.
is what you can expect. Mm-hmm. And then the middle markets can range like crazy. I mean, I have some friends who are getting all in 180,
yeah.
Which is, you know, a pay, you know,
a
they,
pay cut.
There are some third year analysts that make more than that.
Right.
And so,
sounds like my first year in private
people.
Equity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, but there's also some people at, you know, very small middle market funds that as a first year associate, you can start getting carry. So, I mean, you know, and those do still exist. And those are like, you know, the 500 million to below funds. But, if, you know, if you're getting carry in a well-performing fund, you know, you can pass 300 pretty easily in terms of all in.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay. So in terms of yourself, so this is an on-cycle process, so you still have a couple years at your bulge bracket, correct?
Yeah. I've still got two more years left.
So how do you plan to survive, knowing that you have a private equity offer? How are you going to motivate yourself?
I mean, to me, I actually think, you know, I'm just in general a very hardworking person and someone who actually very much enjoys finance and enjoys what I do. Obviously, I don't enjoy, you know, formatting boxes in PowerPoint.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, to me, like there was almost, once I got the job, my biggest concern was what do I do with all my free time now? Because I basically had spent every second I wasn't sleeping or working, I was just prepping for PE interviews.
Yeah, all your free time because you're only working 70 hours a week.
Exactly. I mean, you know, there's 168 hours in a week and every investment banker knows that number.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, if you've got 80 hours, that's, I mean, that's still a solid 88 left. But I think the other big thing is, you know, there is, especially with the early promotions coming in now, I do still have to earn a promotion to associate if I'm going to stay for the full 2 years. So there's still a lot of pressure to continue to be a top performer and stay, you know, stay on the game.
Got it. So what would happen if you didn't? Would your PE offer get rescinded?
You know, honestly, it depends. Depends on the fund, depends on the person. Some mm-hmm. people that...
Oh, that would be amazing if it didn't get...
...happened to and he just started a year early.
Yeah, or it'd be awesome if you didn't get the promo and you could take a year off or 6 months off before starting.
Well, another person that I know actually talked to the PE firm and then worked for a startup for a year.
Very cool.
And, you know, worked for one of his college buddies was starting a small company out in San Fran and he wanted to work for it. You know, it's something that you have to talk to your fund with and you have to make sure they're okay with it. I don't know if they're going to sign off on a year of vacation.
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah.
I don't think you need a year, but 6 months would be nice, or 3 months at least before starting.
Yeah, exactly. But I think from, you know, the few people that I've talked to, the majority have just started a year early.
Got it. Fair enough. And so before we wrap up, any kind of words of wisdom you would have given your younger self?
I mean, it's, you know, it's ridiculous because I started my first semester sophomore year, but start earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you like basically if you especially, you know, if when I was 18 and saying, oh, like, let me just, you know, I just finished high school. Let me just relax for the summer. I think just the biggest thing you can do is just start thinking about what it is that you want to do. And I think the biggest step towards that is just talk to people who are in the industry. And always, always, always talk to people who have done it before for everything. I mean, you know, when I get a pitch book at work, the first thing I, you know, request, the first thing I say is, can I see a precedent? And same thing, like, you know, if you're tasked with a decision or you want to become involved with something,
yeah,
you should always say, well, what have people done before? And talking to those people and learning from them is one, it's great for networking. You know, if I had a high school senior reach out to me because he went to my high school and he found me on LinkedIn, and I was incredibly impressed. I said, keep in touch. And if he emails me next year when recruiting starts, I'll, you know, forward him to HR in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. But then even more so, just, you know, I made a bunch of mistakes, and I would sit myself down and walk myself through those mistakes. But even more importantly, I'd say, you know, if I only get this one conversation with you, instead of wasting it talking to me, just make sure to talk to as many people and find out their mistakes and what they would do differently.
For sure. Well, man, I really appreciate you taking the time. It's been really insightful and went longer than usual, but I think hopefully the listeners enjoyed it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, it's definitely something I enjoyed talking about. I'm, you know, glad that process is behind me, but, you know, I also just want to thank you both for your time and also just, you know, all the resources that WSO provides. You know, it really was my main resource for PE recruiting, and owe a lot of my success to the resources on the website.
Appreciate it, man. Thanks so much.
And thanks to you, my listeners at Wall Street Oasis. If you have any suggestions whatsoever, please don't hesitate to send them my way, Patrick@wallstreetoasis.com. And until next time.